We welcome you to this service that honors transformative power over the long haul. Love and justice are the theme of today's Canadian Unitarian Council's Sharing Our Faith service. Annually, we try to fill you in on what our umbrella association is up to. 3 years ago, the CUC and the Canadian Unitarian Ministers endorsed an expression of truth, healing, and reconciliation. We have been chipping away at some action around this issue ever since. There will be more to come with our exploration and understanding. As Forrest Smith lights our chalice, I'd like to share the words of Reverend Deborah Falk, who is a longtime member of our church and is now the minister at the Unitarian Church of Calgary. As we light this chalice, may it remind us of the light we each are, that love and justice call us to be agents of transformation, envisioning a world with our interdependence shaping all actions and decisions. May we strive to be deeply connected, radically inclusive, and actively engaged, while we remain spiritually grounded and theologically alive.
It's my turn to tell the story of all ages. So if all ages of kids, especially the small ones, would like to come up to the front, if there are any lurking. Okay. So it's my turn to talk to you guys this morning, and I love it when it's my turn to talk to you because you guys are all really interesting people. Because I think that you guys are listening sometimes, and I think that you think about things, and I think that you have interesting conversations. So my story is a true story, and I'm a character in it, but I don't actually know how it started, and I don't know how it ended. But my story is about different ways of saying I'm sorry. So luckily for me, I was born in Argentina, and in Argentina, most people speak Spanish. So till I was about 4 years old, I spoke English and Spanish, and then my parents left Argentina, and I didn't speak Spanish anymore. So I have a little bit of Spanish, but not a huge amount of Spanish. But it came in really handy a few years ago when I was going on a long walk in Spain. And it was so long that it was 800 kilometers, and I had to stop in little hostels. And one night, I stopped in a hostel, and I chatted to the people who were taking care of the people in the hostel in Spanish. And a few minutes later, a guy came up to me, a young man, and he said, "You speak Spanish, right?" And I said, "Yeah, a little bit." And he said, "How do you say I'm sorry in Spanish?" And that was a hard question, actually, because there's lots of ways to say I'm sorry in Spanish. So one of the ways you can say I'm sorry is if you bump into somebody or you step on their toe or something, and then you say, "Oh, perdón, pardon, pardon me, excuse me, didn't mean to do that, perdón." Would that work? And he said, "No, that won't work." I said, "Okay. Well, if you feel bad about something that you said, maybe you could say, 'Lo siento, I feel bad about what I said.' Would that work?" And he said, "No, that won't work." I said, "Okay. Well, if you feel bad that somebody's having a hard time, you could say, 'Me da pena. It hurts me to see that you're having a hard time.' would that work? And he said, no, that won't work. So I said, okay, well, if you're really, really sorry, really sorry, you could ask them to forgive you. You could say, discúlpame, I'm at fault, please forgive me. And he said, yep, that'll work. But then I said, but you know what? Even if you don't speak Spanish, if you say it because it's in your heart and you're sorry, that won't work too. So that's all I have to say. Does anybody have any suggestions about how to say I'm sorry? It's a good thing to practice, even if you're not really sorry, because when you have to say you're sorry, you need to sound like you mean it. So ask your parents how to say you're sorry. Okay, could the... Sorry. Yes. Just say sorry. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Just say sorry. Like you mean it.
The meditation reading this morning is taken from the book The Reason You Walk by Wob Kinew. We stand by those who came before. We love and we hope to be loved. Whether we are young or old, light or dark, whether we are man or woman, we share a common humanity and all are headed for a common destiny. That should bind us together more strongly than divisions can push us apart. So long as anything other than love governs our relationship with others, we have work to do. When the divisions win out, we need to work hard and bring that which has been broken apart back together again. We ought to recognize that our greatest battle is not with one another, but with our pain, our problems, and our flaws. To be hurt yet forgive, to do wrong, but forgive yourself, to depart from this world, leaving only love. This is the reason you walk.
Hi, it's me again. It's my turn to talk to you today, and I really like it when it's my turn to talk to you today, because you guys are interesting people. I really do feel like you think about things. And you talk about things. I really appreciate that. So my name is Sherstine Mackey, and I am a lay chaplain at the church, one of two at the moment. I guess one of the reasons I'm talking to you is because the lay chaplaincy program is one of the other programs supported by the Canadian Unitarian Council. They provide us with training and money, and we send them money too, but it's all good. We wouldn't be doing this without them, so that's why I'm speaking to you today. In my day job, I'm at the Royal British Columbia Museum, downtown Victoria, and I'm a textile conservator, so I deal with mostly the First Nations textiles, and I come into contact with the textiles on the objects and First Nations people every day there at the museum. And I'm really grateful for that. The Royal BC Museum is committed to working with First Nations people and understanding traditional values and traditional traditions and ways of dealing with things, ways of looking with things, ways of supporting people and objects and making it all work together. Sometimes it's hard, but we try. repatriation of the museum, things in the museum, have been going on for decades. So it's not a new thing. It's officially a new thing, but it's not actually a new thing. It's been happening for years. I feel very honored to be part of that process there at the museum. I was there just, I was just 2 weeks ago, had a visit from a lady from the north coast of BC who was moved to tears by looking at an object that lies in our museum, but that was made by her grandmother. And she could see the stitches that her grandmother's hands had put into that blank. And it was wonderful to see. And I was very happy to be able to help be part of that process. I was going to say something about being glad to be part of that process because it feels like it means something real to me. But because I'm meant to be talking about what my work as a lay chaplain, I wanted to say that actually a lot of those feelings come when I'm working as a lay chaplain too. Because we work with people who are at a crossroads in their lives. So it's either a moment of extreme joy for them and sometimes terrible anguish. So it's partly, it's part of what I do. I have to try and find some balance and harmony for people who are feeling that it's a really difficult time for them. And sometimes that's, and sometimes it's not so easy. What we have to do is work to try and create a sacred space and to try and find the words that people have a hard time finding when they're in an extreme moment of their life. Normally we work with people that are outside of this congregation, and we work really to find balance and harmony between traditions, between religions, between people's assumptions and their experiences. For example, I worked with a young couple. The young woman was a Dukhobor lady, and the young man was no particular religion, but they really wanted to honor her traditions. And so we made a sacred table, which in the Dukhobor tradition would have water and bread and salt. And she asked her grandmother to give a blessing in Russian. So that was wonderful. And recently I worked with a couple who was quite a religious couple. They came from a religious family, but their young son had just died of an overdose, and he was atheist, very atheist, and they wanted to honor that. So it was difficult, but we found a way to help them, help the family express their gratitude to the mourners for their understanding that their son's life was precious and that he was mourned. And it didn't really come into it where those feelings came from, just that they were there. And even more recently, I helped conduct a funeral for a 95-year-old woman whose three sons were adamant that she was a religious person and wanted lots of God in the ceremony. So we did that for her. But it was interesting that towards the end of the ceremony, during the open mic part, the old woman's neighbor from down the hall said, "Yes, but I went there the night she died, and I asked her if she wanted to pray with me. And she said, no." She said, "Smile." So I thought that was also a wonderful thing. So this morning I talked to the kids about how to say I'm sorry to somebody. As a lay chaplain, I feel like I actually have a bit more translation to do sometimes. Kind of how to say hello, how to say welcome, how to say I'm sorry, how to say goodbye. It's all part of the big story. But like I said to the kids, I really do feel that if you say it with your heart, whatever you're saying, then that's all you need to say. Thank you.
Last May, at the annual CUC conference on the unceded land of the Musqueam First Nations, I joined about 50 other people to experience a taste of the Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation Reflection Guide that two UU ministers are starting to develop. And I think we all know, or some of us know, Meg Roberts and Samaya Oakley, both of whom will be here at our church during our minister's sabbatical. Together, we engaged in an experimental exploration of the effects of the residential school system. We did a variation on the blanket exercise that some of us participated in last year, and it was also led by the Kairos folks. We role-played the parts of Aboriginal people, colonists, church, and government folks as we played our parts in British Columbia from 1840 to the present. In a large space with more people, it was a very powerful experience. Some of the roles that we played were 5 to 7-year-old children, parents, their aunts, their uncles, their grandparents, priests, nuns, teachers, and government agents. We learned empathy for the families. We learned the truth about colonization and Indian residential schools. We learned some of the impacts, not just in the past, but as the trickle-down effect is being experienced by First Nations people and families today. Can you imagine what it would have been like to grow up in a community without children? Without your own children? Diana and I thought that it might be an interesting exercise for us to do today to find out exactly how much of an Aboriginal story you have. So I would like to ask you to please stand or wave your hand as I ask you. One, have you ever worked or lived on an Aboriginal reserve? Did you go to school with Aboriginal children? Do you have a personal friend or a family member who is Aboriginal? Who has seen the 7 swirling or spinning whirls around Vancouver or around Victoria and Esquimalt? They're called the signs of Lekwungen, which was the original language of this area. Do you live on the unceded land of the Esquimalt Nation? Who went to university with an Aboriginal person? Who lives on the unceded land of the Songhees Nation? Who lives on the unceded land of the Paquichin Nation or the Sachem Nation or the Tsawwa'at Nation? Anyone who didn't put their hand up? Good point. Well, you own part of this church, which sits on the Tsartlip Nation, unceded territory. We all have some Aboriginal story. So back to last May at the CUC annual meeting, Viola Thomas from Reconciliation Canada reflected on her experiences as a residential school survivor. Like many of us growing up in the same culture, each person's story is different. She encouraged us to work for reconciliation. I was keen to come back to Victoria and start doing something with our congregation and our First Nations neighbors. But how? When I review my own life as a native-born Canadian, albeit only four generations of my people have been here from Europe, I know that Aboriginal people have always been part of my Canadian experience. Fringy. Being raised on the prairies, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Manitoba, I had always had a few First Nations and Métis kids in my school classes. I even had a really big crush on Billy Giles, who was in my grade 5 class. He had such beautiful, long, black, shiny hair and deep black eyes, and all the other kids had blonde brush cuts. Looking back, I realized now that I grew up in a very privileged white society. People of color were not much a part of my daily experience, which may be why I thought going to the Calgary Stampede every year when I was in elementary school was so exotic. We never went to the chuck wagon races or the bronco riding. That cost money. Instead, we went to the Blackfoot and Cree villages. I loved the huge teepees. I loved the architecture of the strong triangular forms. Each teepee was decorated with individual and unusual markings. And the beautiful costumes. Oh, gorgeous colors and textures. My dad even made me a beading loom when I was 8 years old so I could try to learn how to bead, because I loved all the moccasins and jackets. And he had learned beading when he was a teenager from one of his scout leaders in Northern Ontario. Mel was a Métis. Everybody knew how to bead, right? One of my cousins married a Sioux woman from the Whitecap Dakota First Nation in Saskatchewan, and their kids all come to our family reunions. They all now live in Regina, where they continue to face the struggles of urban life as a mixed family. I was stepmother to a teenage Blackfoot boy who had been adopted off his reserve by a well-meaning white family in the 1970s. In Alberta. His birth parents were likely substance abusers and deemed unfit to raise their child. This stepson struggled to fit into the middle-class white culture, and finally, as an adult, he reclaimed his Blackfoot status and is now much more comfortable with who he was born to be. And through the years, when we arrived here on this Sartlet property, I have been happy to be involved with the First Nations art shows that we've sponsored here. And if you remember, that was because Keith Jobson asked the question of the Sartlet band, what can we do? What can we do to help you? Recently, I attended a Cinecenta film called We Can't Make the Same Mistake Twice. It was a long and powerful film following the lawsuit against Canada's Department of Indian Affairs by the Assembly of First Nations, led by Dr. Cindy Blackstock. The suit was based on a Human Rights Act and pleaded for the rights of all reserved children to be treated like regular off-reserve children. The appalling part of that court case was that it took 8 years to actually get to the Supreme Court. I believe that we need to discover the truth of the residential school era in our country before we can begin to do the healing and reconciliation with this nation's Indigenous people. I'm still as keen as I was last May to get something going in our congregation. We have the possibility of applying for innovation money from the Ruth Humphreys Fund. What could we envision together?
So as I said, I grew up on a farm near Stony Plain, west of Edmonton. I was the granddaughter of a Swedish-born settler, an early homesteader, and daughter of an immigrant, a Dutch war bride. And I know now that this was the traditional lands of the Cree Nakoda First Peoples, Treaty 6 Reserve, west of Edmonton, at Lake Wabamun. The Indians, as we called them, were always part of my life. Some moments that stand out. I was 3 years old. I remember a knock at the farmhouse door. My dad answered the door, and I was very curious to see who it was. And I noticed a woman, a dark-haired woman, holding a baby, a toddler beside her, asking for milk and food. And I realized they were the family that had arrived earlier that day, set up a teepee in the field of our farm to help my dad clear some land. Another vivid memory, an old truck coming down the driveway. A man with his family selling fish. They came often. They were different than us somehow. The fish was delicious. And on treaty days, the natives came to town to buy groceries and supplies, and some went to the hotel that was at the end of the street. I remember there was a separate entrance for the beer parlor. I don't remember any children. Not until high school when a few came. I now know there was an elementary school on the reserve. And I remember loving the dancing and the drumming at the festivals, beautiful costumes. My family, they were good people. And they taught me that Indians were different than us. Leave them alone. They have their own lives. Watch out for those who were drunk or panhandlers. We had to pity them. My uncle, the town policeman, often took the troublemakers back to the reserve. When I was 18, I had a summer job at the Charles Campbell TB San in Edmonton, where the Inuit from northern Canada came for treatment. That was my first direct experience with institutionalization. And deep within, somewhere, those early experiences helped shape who I became as an adult, an activist, a change agent, a person committed to systems change. For 15 years, I was in Ottawa, and I was the executive director of nonprofit organizations working with women's, children's, community issues. So I worked side by side with Indigenous leaders. My connections were in conference rooms, policy and lobbying efforts for children's issues, community services. They were incredible people. People from whom I learned resilience, persistence, courage, and humility. I glimpsed how they walked in two worlds, with grace, sometimes with hurt, sometimes with anguish. And I, and many of you know some of them, I think. People like Cindy Blackshawk, who spent their lives in pursuit of justice for those who are most vulnerable. And for the past 18 years when I've been in BC, I've worked as a consultant in health, social, civil society, social services, blah, blah, blah. And I have engaged, again, with many Aboriginal, Indigenous people in what now seem like endless efforts. I've faced the bureaucratic juggernauts, the disconnect, the inequality, the injustice, and the good intentions and the slow progress that we've made. I think of an example in Port Hardy, where we were involved in a health system redesign initiative. A Native elder standing up and saying, "My needs are very basic. Our children are eating Pop-Tarts because we can't afford to buy the fruits and vegetables that we really need for them." And as a leadership educator, I've had the privilege of working with many incredible Indigenous, Aboriginal, Dene, and Inuit leaders. I think of two in particular. Patrick, who is a traditional chief from a very small band in northern BC, who was doing his master's degree, living with the tension of wanting to respect the ways of the elders and the traditional beliefs that meant, and also wrestling with the need for economic development to deal with the abject poverty that his people were facing. And I remember him saying, you know, sometimes I think it would be easier if I just went to Vancouver and got a job at Burger King. And that's the kind of reality that so many of those kinds of leaders are leading. Another one I remember is Reginald, who was a child of people who had gone to residential school, a Dene man, had become an RCMP officer, highly regarded, recognized for the value that he provided. And what I remember him saying is, you know, here's what I wrestle with. My job is to defend the laws of the land, and I respect that. But my brother's an alcoholic, and my parents really want me to help him in a traditional family way, and I can't do both. So I've been on the land in many places, all places of energy and beauty and reverence. I've participated in many ceremonies, healing circles, sweat lodge, powwows, which have touched me to the depths of my soul. I've had, and I still have, remarkable teachers among Indigenous leaders. And I honor and deeply respect their perspective on lineage and their ancestors, the importance of ceremony, the listening, the watching, the learning that happens in circle, the holistic worldview. And they're part of a strong group of Native leaders, intelligentsia in this country, that truly are idle no more. They're flourishing, leading by example. They're in many positions of influence in business, government, and civil society. And I and many of you are allies in spirit and in action for what they've done. So I've tried to do all that I could or all that I knew every step of the way. Being empathetic, and I am an educated white woman of privilege, part of the dominant culture. I have power and I have influence because of my white skin, because of my position. I've never experienced abuse, violence, extreme poverty, the impact of intergenerational trauma. And I see at this stage of my life that there are many more layers that I need to unpeel. Those layers of my unconscious bias that lie below my thinking and feeling self. And I struggle deeply, as I know you do too, with the hypocrisy, the abuse that happened in residential schools. Why weren't we told? Why weren't we more involved? What more could we have done? I feel so sad at how we failed our first people. Missing women, boil water advisories, all the trauma that comes from the results of residential schools. In a country like Canada that's so rich in so many ways, and right here in our neighborhood, in our city, those stereotypical responses continue. And I'm so aware, and I think you probably are too, that you and I often unconsciously perpetuate those. I've been brokenhearted by a couple of personal experiences I've had in the last couple of weeks that leave me quite raw and unsettled. One, a healing circle I participated in, and the policeman involved arrived with his flak jacket on, which for me was a symbol of the difference in power and perspective that we have around issues that matter to all of us. So, folks, this is the time. There's an Anna Schwabe prophecy that says this is the time for us to come together to build justice and harmony. So who do we choose to be? What are we ready for? I know that many of you are more involved, engaged, tremendous contributions, and this is a comfortable pew, a place of sanctuary that keeps our privilege and our patterns in place. Pat mentioned the work of the Canadian Unitarian Council in the last couple of years. In January, Lynn Beek and I participated in training to become facilitators of the reflection process that they've developed. And it's a worthy process. I think both of us were really heartened by the commitment to us really engaging with Indigenous perspectives, developing an understanding of intercultural competencies, how to relate better, to connect to our biases, our truths, through deep dialogue, and humbly creating the foundation for real healing and reconciliation. So where we take this journey as a congregation, here and beyond our walls, is up to us to decide. And who do we choose to be? What action do we want to take? I hope you'll stay and have some conversation with Pat, Lynn, and I after the service. We'll just be here for until we go to the farmhouse common room at noon for further conversation. I think this matters most to me, and I will not be a bystander, because I think we have a strength. And our strength lies in appreciating and learning from the similarities and differences between Indigenous and non-Indigenous worldviews, which contribute not only to the healing in this country, but to a fair, inclusive, and healthy communities for all people, wherever they are. It's a pathway in. Susan read from Wabkinew's book, and Wabkinew, as many of you know, is a contemporary Aboriginal leader from Manitoba, a politician, a journalist. And his closing words were, "To be heard, hurt, yet forgive. To do wrong, but forgive yourself. To depart from this world, leaving only love. This is the reason you walk." So who do we choose to be for these times? Let's talk.
Our closing words for this morning are from Starhawk, from This Earth Path. When a system is whole and healthy, when it is based on relationships of interdependence and cooperation that further resilience, diversity, abundance, sustainability, creativity, and freedom, it exhibits what humans call justice.